This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The NBA has never lacked for movers and for shakers, although it got monotonous when every year the Lakers would roll past lesser teams while coining sayings like three-peat. But then the Lakers lost, and now Shaq Diesel is a Heat. Does all this mean the Pistons will prevail again this season? I'm joined now by an expert with the picks and with the reasons, I hope. The aforementioned expert joining us as the NBA season gets underway is Mary Schmidt Boyer of the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Mary, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks so much for having me.
The newly reconstituted Lakers won their opener against the Denver Nuggets. Then they got blown out by Utah the next night. I wonder, is this a sign that maybe Kobe needs the big kid in the middle more than he thought he would?
I don't think Kobe will ever admit that. But certainly, that seemed to be quite a surprising result. People are now looking at Utah saying, oh boy, they're going to have to look out for the Jazz now.
Well, we're going to get back to the Western Conference, but let's look at the Eastern Conference for a minute first, because after all, the Detroit Pistons, out of the East, won the World Championship about 3 weeks ago, it seems to me.
I think that's right.
Yeah. Anyway, Detroit could be even better than they were when they upset L.A. back in June. How good are their chances for a repeat?
Well, I think a lot of people, in fact, are picking them to repeat. They have made some good additions. They were a good, obviously, the thing people are focusing on is the nature of the team and the fact that they didn't have necessarily a superstar, Rasheed Wallace notwithstanding. And it was interesting in kind of preseason conference calls with a lot of the NBA coaches, a lot of people were asked, doesn't this put more emphasis on the team instead of getting one or two superstars and trying to make them work together?
Much has been made of Shaquille O'Neal's aforementioned switch to the Eastern Conference playing in Miami, and even though he said he was at, quote, 65.212%, whatever that means, the Heat beat New Jersey on Wednesday night. Can this team be a championship contender even with an injured Shaq and a lesser supporting cast?
You know, you certainly have to say yes, especially in the Eastern Conference. Some people would question whether Miami has a weaker cast, especially with Dwayne Wade, who certainly, you know, has proven that perhaps he was kind of overlooked last year, even though he, you know, was a contender in Rookie of the Year voting, took Miami much farther in the playoffs than either LeBron James, who won the award, or Carmelo Anthony. So he certainly seems to be an up-and-coming star. And more importantly, he seems to be the kind of kid who doesn't need the attention that Kobe did.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe in Orlando that Penny Hardaway did.
Let's look a little bit at your backyard. LeBron James, the most talked about teenager ever to play in the NBA, lived up to almost everybody's expectations last year. Now the grizzled 20-year-old vet is expected to lead his Cleveland Cavaliers to the Eastern Conference playoffs. Yes?
Expected, yes. that is certainly the notion that the Cavs are going into the season with. They made a lot of changes on this team, and as has been my experience in my years here, it takes a while for that to all settle down and kind of mesh together, and I'm on the pessimistic side. I'm not sure you can keep doing that year after year after year, but to answer your initial question, yes, they expect to make the playoffs, and I think part of the fact is nobody knows what's going on in so much of the East. That with a piece like LeBron and certainly point guard Jeff McGinnis, you know, they think they're positioned to make the playoffs this year.
Back in the West, a lot of people seem to think that the fact that the Lakers are bound to be weaker benefits maybe the Minnesota Timberwolves more than anybody else with their star Kevin Garnett. The Wolves won their first playoff series ever last year. Do we see them going a little further, maybe even to the finals this time around?
Well, I have to tell you, sort of full disclosure, I was actually one of the first beat writers for the Minnesota Timberwolves, so nothing would make me happier than to see them make it to the NBA Finals. I was really pulling for them last year. You know, they too are positioned. How much Latrell Sprewell's kind of pouting here at the beginning of the season over his contract.
This is shocking. Shocking
oh,
that
shocking.
Latrell Sprewell is thinking about anything other than playing basketball.
Well, but as many people point out, once he gets on the court, he does play hard. And amazingly, players do not seem to take any of that personally. You know, it's always the media that's outraged. How could you do this to your teammates? But athletes are just sort of, oh, you know, it's just another day kind of thing, and let's play basketball. So they seem to be much more forgiving than those of us in the media are.
Mary, we have only been able to talk about a few of the many talented players who changed teams in the off season. There seem to be at least 10 teams, as I look at it, with at least a reasonable shot of making the finals, and a few of them are even in the Eastern Conference. Is it
at least a couple.
Is it safe to say of this season that it is as uncertain as any has been in quite a long time?
I would say so. In fact, I will admit to you that every once in a while, I catch myself watching TV or reading a box score and going, oh, I didn't know he was there. It's going to take a little while here to just remember who is in what uniform. And you know, maybe that's a good thing for the NBA, that it's not going to be the Lakers and or San Antonio and you know, I can't think of a really good Eastern team, but
now that is certainly, you know, emblematic of something even now in the NBA.
Right. And again, I would say in the East the door is wide open, although the Pistons certainly, because of their experience, have to be considered a favorite going in. Miami with Shaq, you can't discount that. Beyond those two, I would hesitate to designate any team a sure finalist.
Mary Schmidt-Boyer covers the NBA for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Mary, thank you very much for joining us.
It has been my pleasure.
On Tuesday, Cowboys fans in Arlington, Texas, were urged to avoid the face paint and leave their big blue stars at home. That's because in Texas, wearing political slogans to the polls is illegal. And in Arlington, 20 miles west of Dallas, residents were voting on a $325 million tax increase to bring the team to town. As Glenn Mitchell of member station KERA reports, despite the lack of blue and white at the polling stations, America's team still won.
The Cowboys deserted Dallas proper for Texas Stadium in suburban Irving in the early 70s. But several years ago, Irving refused to help finance the updating of the stadium. And earlier this year, negotiations with Dallas to build a new stadium downtown broke down. Arlington stepped in, and the fight was on between those who thought a publicly financed stadium would be good and those who thought Cowboys owner Jerry Jones should build it for himself. Alan Sachs is a professor of political science at the University of Texas at Arlington, who's written a history of the city. He says in the past, Arlington voters have repeatedly refused to use tax money for public projects.
Arlington has voted down in the past decade or so several propositions on a proposal to build a water walk, very much like they have in San Antonio, Texas. There was a proposition, several propositions about that in Arlington, to develop an old creek in this community that is repeatedly flooded. We've also had proposals on the ballot over the past decade or so, in fact, three propositions about mass transit.
Now Arlington will raise taxes to put up $325 million, half the cost of the retractable roof 75,000-seat stadium. In return, it will get $2 million a year in rent, a percentage from naming rights, and a $16.5 million donation to the city's youth sports programs. Jim Runsheimer of the group No Jones Tax said the city's giving up too much.
The bottom line is that this money that would be used for taxes belongs to Arlington residents and small businesses. Let's get government off our backs, out of our pocketbooks. Let's let businesses and individuals keep this money and spend it in the ways that they best choose to use. This is basically a desperate act on the part of our city government to give $325 million to one specific business with absolutely no commitment by Jerry Jones to bring in any type of development whatsoever.
Arlington City Councilman Ron Wright argued using tax revenues to lure the Cowboys was simply good business as usual.
This should be viewed for what it is. It's an economic incentive. We're using sales tax to incentivize economic growth in Arlington. This is done at all levels of government. It's done by conservatives in government. Cities use sales tax and tax abatements to incentivize economic growth in cities.
On Election Day in Arlington, some voters opposed not only the measure, but the stadium itself.
Taxes, too much construction, traffic, don't want it. Because I don't want to have extra taxes on things when I have
visitors. I don't want the extra traffic involved, and I don't think that it will improve on the crime like they say it will.
But promises that the new stadium would bring 2,000 new jobs to the area did appeal to this voter.
I voted for the stadium because of the jobs involved, not just the people working during the games, but also the boosting the economy with the hotels, the restaurants, retail sales, maintenance, construction, administration, everything involved.
By a week before the election, Pro Stadium forces had spent more than $4.5 million to promote their position. Opponents only $44,000. But the Pro Stadium side also had an extra edge. Radio and TV ads featuring former Cowboys stars helped the ad blitz. And Professor Alan Sachs agrees that Riverwalks and buses didn't have quite the same appeal as America's team.
And I do believe that a lot of people voted for it, and I'm one of them, just because it was the Dallas Cowboys, one of the greatest sports franchises in the entire world. And that obviously was a very, very big selling point.
Team officials hope to have the new stadium open by early 2008. For Only a Game, this is Glenn Mitchell in Dallas.
We love the good Dallas Cowboys. The best of the good times that we've ever had. We love the good Dallas Cowboys. Hell, we love them when they.
Should you feel the inclination to send Only a Game a message, learn more about the program, or perhaps listen to the odd Only a Game that you've missed, visit our website, onlyagame.org.
Ain't nothing like a game day sports bar, pulling on a Lone Star, chomping on a chicken fried steak.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. What is customarily Australia's biggest occasion for betting on the ponies turned out to be a pretty good day for locksmiths. Early Tuesday morning, mere hours before the 144th running of the Melbourne Cup, known as, quote, the race that stops a nation, operators of 25 betting parlors in Melbourne discovered that the locks on their establishments had been filled with quick-drying glue. Six locksmiths rushed around Melbourne, ensuring that bettors would only briefly be inconvenienced in their determination to wager on the race. Those picking Maccabee Diva, who captured the cup for the second consecutive year, were especially grateful.
I'm gonna stick like glue. Stick because I'm stuck on you. Hide in the kitchen.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Uganda's favorite defensive end. But first, all manner of unusual suspects have risen to the top of the college football heap this season, while some of the previously dependable juggernauts have stalled and stumbled, in some cases fumbled, even tumbled. Joining me now to shed some light on the collegiate game as we approach the bowl season is Dan Wetzel of Yahoo.com Sports. Dan, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Dan, the last time we spoke, we weren't allowed to talk about the bowl championship series, but... Oh, wait, all right, wait a minute. Stop. Come on, the polls are out. We have to talk about it now.
Time. It's time.
Anyways, USC and Oklahoma are the two top teams in the BCS standings. Dan, is there any reason to think that that will change in coming weeks?
Barring an upset, no, they won't change. And really, there isn't a lot of things in the way that could cause that. Southern Cal, 8-0, has a favorable schedule the rest of the way. Oklahoma does have some tough games. There's Texas A&M coming up. The Big 12 is pretty competitive in the south part of the league. So it's possible they could lose. But, you know, at this point, these two teams have shown themselves to be so resilient and so good that we could very well get the USC-Oklahoma matchup.
Now, of course, only two teams do get to play for the national title, and that nearly always means there's at least one deserving team that's left out. Undefeated Auburn could be that team this year. Can you make a case for the Tigers if they do wind up undefeated and don't get to the national championship game?
Well, you definitely can, and what the possibility of Auburn is the same possibility that LSU had last year. The SEC is such a strong league that you just rack up so many good wins that the computer formula can kind of bounce you up there. Now, the difference in the BCS this year and last year is they de-emphasize the computer polls. The human polls are more important than the computer rankings. So there's where Auburn may not make it. They also play in the weaker side of the SEC. But, you know, it's going to be tough. If Auburn runs the table in a league like the Southeastern Conference, which includes winning the SEC title game, which they would play maybe Tennessee or Georgia, and have to win one of those games again, you know, it's going to be tough for Auburn to sit there and say, hey, this isn't fair, we're not playing. You'll have the same controversy that we always have, which is there's three teams trying to play for two spots.
But you mentioned the kind of tweaking that's gone on in this process of the Bowl Championship Series. How much more tweaking can the institution endure before it just falls apart at the seams?
Well, it doesn't have a lot of credibility. I mean, there's no question about that. So, you know, fans do not trust the BCS. And now what they tried to do this year is say, well, let's rely on what the human eye says, and this is the better team, and these two teams are the best teams, and let's play. You know, eventually this is going to go to a playoff. Now, what is eventually? 10 years? 15 years? I don't know. You know, I myself am in favor of the playoffs, so I'm kind of believing the situational anarchist in this case. We want as much controversy as possible so they blow this system up.
It brings the system down more quickly.
That's
if there's
right.
more controversy.
I'm generally not in favor of anarchy, but in this case, we need to topple the system. Let's have them all go undefeated and have everybody upset until they just have a playoff. That makes sense. And, you know, the playoff works in Division I AA, Division II, Division III, you know, and there's a ton of money on the table. Everything is positive for the playoff as far as I'm concerned.
There are some new teams among the college football elite this year. The Golden Bears of Cal Berkeley, number 4 in the BCS. Are there fans wondering if, given Berkeley's history, this is all just a big hallucination?
Considering that until this year, the greatest moment in Cal football history was probably when they spike the ball on the Stanford tuba player's head in the great play. Yes, I think this is something else. Cal Berkeley has done an incredible job. They were this good last year. This was the team that beat Southern Cal last year that created a lot of that controversy, and they lost a very tight game to the Trojans down in SC. This team's legit. They're the top one-loss team in the country right now, having only lost to Southern Cal. So you're not hallucinating. You're not having flashbacks.
I'm so happy to hear that.
You're not getting a contact buzz at a Berkeley coffee shop. The Bears are for real.
And the mighty Utes of Utah are undefeated and could be the first school from outside the big conferences to play in a BCS bowl. That might shake the system up a little, no?
Definitely. Well, it shakes it up because it'll drag a lot of money, you know, about $11 million out of the traditional schools that get the money to a school that doesn't get it. And I think it's great. Utah deserves this. They're undefeated. They have maybe the best young coach in the country, and a man named Urban Meyer, who's a real offensive genius. They've won very good games. They trounced Texas A&M, which is ranked early in the year. They trounced North Carolina, which just last week beat Miami, Florida. They're legit. They have a great offense. They have very aggressive defense. I think this is the underdog team. I think America wants to see a team like this play in a big bowl game, and I think they deserve it. I think if they can continue to keep running the table, and they've just been dominant all year, it hasn't even been close, they'll get in that top six slot and get to play in one of the big games, probably the Fiesta Bowl.
This year's Heisman Trophy may go to an Oklahoma Sooner, but it might not be quarterback Jason White who won the award last year. This time, the favorite is a freshman running back who could make history.
Well, Adrian Peterson is that running back, and a freshman has never won the Heisman Trophy, but there is no question that Adrian Peterson is the best player on the Oklahoma Sooners, and Oklahoma is undefeated and ranked number 2 in the country. He has routinely racked up 200-plus yard games, completely outdueled Cedric Benson of Texas in the big Red River shootout. You know, if you were picking up sides right now and said, I want a player, Adrian Peterson would probably be the guy that you would want, just a tremendous player. You know, Jason White won the award last year basically because Oklahoma had a great season as a team. He put up some good numbers. This is not a guy that will play in the NFL. Adrian Peterson is going to be a guy you're going to hear about on Saturdays for the next few years and on Sundays. And really it's about, can the voters overcome the bias against a freshman? Because, you know, I think it's a very, very legitimate case that he's the best player in football right now.
Okay, so here's the follow-up question. If you win the Heisman Trophy as a freshman, and then you win it 3 more years, do they retire it?
it just becomes the Peterson.
It becomes the Peterson Trophy.
If he ends up with three or four Heisman trophies, they ought to just rename it the Adrian Peterson.
Dan Wetzel is a columnist for Yahoo Sports, and he's no longer afraid to talk to us about the Bowl Championship Series. Dan, thanks again.
It's the great drama of the fall.
On Wednesday afternoon, coming off an upset win over Notre Dame 2 weeks ago, the Boston College football team was hard at preparation for today's game against Rutgers. A measure of BC's recent success can be attributed to 6'7.5", 260-pound defensive end and captain Matthias Kiwanuka, who, if he opts out of a fifth year and makes himself eligible for April's National Football League draft, could be on his way to a pro career, according to Matt Hayes, who covers college football for the Sporting News.
Well, I think Matthias has shown in college that he can be a very effective and efficient pass rusher, and I don't think he gets the respect publicity-wise that he could get. I think he's a very good end, and I think he's among the best ends in the nation.
Though he initially preferred basketball, Kiwanuka has been thinking about a career in the NFL for several years now. The possibility of going pro was enhanced after last season when he was named to the Big East Conference's first team, and Kiwanuka acknowledges that he'd relish an opportunity to play at the next level.
I think almost every college football player wants to play in the NFL. I mean, it's kind of like a dream. Once you get to this level, knowing that so few people actually make it to Division I college football, that, you know, just to be that close, you know, it's kind of, you know, you just want to put everything you can into it. At least, you know, if the dream doesn't come true, at least you know that you gave it 100%.
If Kiwanuka shares that determination to pursue a pro football career with hundreds, if not thousands, of other college players, his plans for life beyond the game set him apart.
An NFL career isn't that long, you know, typically. So, I mean, I definitely foresee my life after football. I don't know exactly where it's going to take me, but going back to Uganda is definitely on my short list of things to do.
Kiwanuka's parents were born in Uganda, and his grandfather, Benedicto Kiwanuka, served as that country's first prime minister, beginning in 1961. In September of 1972, former president for life Idi Amin had Kiwanuka assassinated. According to Professor Hugo Kamya, a Ugandan who teaches clinical social work at Boston College, arranges for students to visit Africa, and runs a program benefiting Ugandan children, Benedicto Kiwanuka was a leader the struggling country could ill afford to lose.
He was a very amiable person. Indeed, many people feel that that was a big, deep loss that the country suffered at the time. He was a very generous guy. Benedict Kiwanuka was very forthright in his views and was really fighting for the rights of the poor and the oppressed and really struggling to help people, especially the disenfranchised.
Benedicto Kiwanuka's struggles were life and death. His grandson's adventures in leadership have come as captain of a college team playing a game, but Professor Kamya sees similarities between the two men.
The leaders of the time had sought for the most part to disunite people and pull them apart in a way of ruling the country. But Benedicto was such a unifier, and I think it's that same quality that Matthias is bringing to a team like this and to a situation like this.
Though he was born in the U.S. and has not visited the homeland of his parents and grandparents since he was in third grade, Matthias Kiwanuka takes pride in his heritage, and he displays that pride on a tattoo between his shoulder blades.
It's a pretty fair-sized tattoo. It's about that big on the back of my neck.
Like a big sort of House of Pancakes-sized pancake.
Yeah. It's a presidential seal of Uganda. It's got a cob and a gazelle, and then there's a shield, and then there's a drum and a sun inside the shield, and then two arrows going across it.
Ultimately, Matthias Kiwanuka plans to demonstrate his allegiance to and concern for the country of his parents and grandparents in less flamboyant ways. Based on the response to what he has accomplished at Boston College, he feels that if he makes the NFL, visiting Uganda will have a significant positive impact.
I don't think that pro-American football is a big part of their culture, but from what I've heard, you know, just me and my family, like all the success that I've had has kind of created a little bit of a buzz back there. So I think it'd be more of a sense of, you know, having one of their own in a position of success, and that's what would draw the most attention. I just think the whole AIDS epidemic is torn the country apart, and from, you know, just reading the papers and talking with my family and everything, that seems to be what's on everybody else's mind. So I figured, you know, if I could help with what, you know, the people are thinking, what's on their minds, that would be the place that I would start.
Professor Hugo Kamya has known Matthias Kiwanuka since Kiwanuka was a small boy. Kamya was living in Uganda when Matthias's grandfather was assassinated, as he talks about the prospect of Benedicto Kiwanuka's grandson returning to the country, a smile spreads across his face.
Certainly, Matthias would not be short of work to do, and I can see him, given what I know of him here in this country and also on this campus, that he would be a terrific help to the people there. I can see him quite thriving in that situation there. So I would say welcome. Yeah.
Professor Kamya has no illusions about the ability of one man, even a man who's the grandson of a national hero and stands 6'7", to solve Uganda's problems, which, he laments, include not only the devastation of a generation by AIDS, but widespread illiteracy and hunger. Still, he's encouraged and delighted that this young football player, a proven leader on the field, is eager to take up a leadership role in a larger, more significant realm. For Matthias Kiwanuka, that commitment feels natural.
The country, you know, definitely needs a lot of help, and they can use all the help they can get. And just with, you know, my heritage and everything that it's given me, I feel like I, you know, have an obligation to go back and help the people who a lot of times are my first cousins and my parents' siblings and things like that. So, I mean, I would just go back and listen and try to get a better understanding of what's exactly going on in the country and figure out how I can help.
Precisely when Matthias Kiwanuka will return to Uganda depends on several factors, among them whether he'll play an additional season at Boston College, having been redshirted during his freshman year, and whether, assuming he has a pro career, he'll decide to put off traveling to Africa until that career is over or work it into the time between seasons. When the time does come, Professor Hugo Kamya is sure Matthias Kiwanuka will make an impression.
People are following the players, they're following the teams. So I think he would be noted, and he would be noted, first of all, because of being the grandson of former Prime Minister of Uganda. But also, Boston College is known for its football team and also for its academic excellence. So they would pay attention.
Somewhere there may be a better rationale for football than that it gives its stars an opportunity to help people less fortunate than themselves. On the other hand, maybe not. You're listening to Only a Game. Adriano Galliani, the president of the Armani Company and also of Milan's Olympia professional basketball team, announced this week that he wants Michael Jordan to come out of retirement again to play in Italy and presumably to wear Armani clothing whenever he's not in uniform, which wouldn't be a stretch. Italy's best-selling Sports Daily reported that Giorgio Armani himself thinks employing Michael is a terrific idea. Michael Jordan is a rare, if not unique, phenomenon, and 18 months after his most recent retirement, it may have been his third, I've lost track, he still looks great in a well-tailored suit, so it's not hard to understand why Messrs. Armani and Galliani want to employ him. But Jordan is also representative of a very small number of athletes so gifted, so accomplished, and so revered that the public at large has a problem accepting that their careers could ever be over. Willie Mays was among them, Babe Ruth, of course, Muhammad Ali. The evidence was clear in those cases that the athletes had stayed too long in the arena, but they were all so big within their games that it was hard to imagine the games without them. Likewise, Michael Jordan. When he retired the first time, the question that dominated the sports page was, who will be the next Michael Jordan? When the answer turned out to be Michael Jordan, everybody was happy again. This is not to say the Jordan-bereft NBA is lacking in stars, for certainly it isn't, but the NBA is lacking in icons because they don't come around all that often. That was the slot Jordan filled. Admirers, by which I mean those in whom he inspired wonder, chronicled his deeds on and off the court and credited him with creating a revolution in marketing and altering the nature of race relations by charming white folks so thoroughly that they forgot he was black. The extent to which Michael Jordan did this is debatable. Race still seems to be something of an issue, but perception is all, and the perception of the importance and the achievement of Michael Jordan apparently defied exaggeration. All of which means it's no surprise that Olympia Milan and Armani wish to employ Michael Jordan, because it will be news if they do. And it will perhaps be no surprise if he takes advantage of the opportunity. Because once one has been an icon, it must be difficult, don't you think, and dull to wake to mortality.
When the stars make you drool just like pasta puzzle, that's amore.
That's amore.
When you dance down the street with the cloud at your feet, you're in love. When you walk in a dream, but you know you're not dreaming, signore.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a college English professor does his best impression of George Plimpton. But first, I'm joined by our analyst, Charlie Pierce, for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The game at the top of the NFL heap tomorrow finds the undefeated Philadelphia Eagles facing their Pennsylvania rivals, the Pittsburgh Steelers. Aren't games like this usually played on Thanksgiving?
Blue State, rah, rah, rah. No, this is an interesting football game. Philadelphia is the only undefeated team left in the NFL, and the reason they're the only undefeated team in the NFL is because Pittsburgh beat up on the New England Patriots last weekend behind the rookie quarterback named Ben Roethlisberger, who is apparently everything everybody thought Drew Bledsoe was going to be many years back, except he's a little taller and a little stronger. And Pittsburgh looked very, very good against the Patriots last
week. Well, since you have brought up the Patriots, I think we should extend a tip of the helmet to the New England Patriots. They did break the record for number of consecutive games won in the National Football League. Do they win any more this fall?
Oh, sure. I still think they'll end up somewhere between 12-4 and 10-6. 21 games in a row in the modern NFL, given the way players move around, given the injury factor, given everything else, is a remarkable achievement. Of course, it got buried locally here because of the
couple of baseball games.
Because of the couple of baseball games and the eclipse of the moon and the sudden arrival of the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse at Park Street Under. But it really is it's something the Patriots can be very proud of. But now, after the Pittsburgh game, the Patriots are facing something they haven't really faced in that run, which is a spate of really bad injuries.
On Monday, Ricky Williams officially applied for reinstatement in the National Football League. Some of the Dolphins, the team from which Williams, quote-unquote, retired, have apparently begun to see him as trade bait. Is he a desirable commodity
Don't
at this point?
Bogart that bonus, my friend. Pass it over to me. No, he will not return to the Miami Dolphins. He will play somewhere in the NFL next year. It will not be there, and he will not do so for the money he thinks he's worth.
On Thursday, Steve Spurrier decided that he doesn't want to coach again at Florida after all. Does an NFL team in trouble immediately decide Coach Spurrier
no!
is the answer?
No, of course not. He's a failure in the NFL.
Well, he's only had one shot. Right?
I think he's looked at the Florida job and decided that, Ben there done that and Ron Zook has sort of run the program into the ground. He doesn't feel like rebuilding anything right now. I think you'll find a college that is looking to build from the ground up and let Steve Spurrier be the tiny little emperor that he's always wanted to be. I don't think you'll see him back in the NFL anytime soon.
The opening night of the NBA season saw the champion Detroit Pistons receiving their championship hubcaps. Do you suppose the logic here is that a ring that big is more difficult to lose?
Well, I know it's more difficult to slip under your coat and get out the door with if you're trying to steal it. I mean, this picture, I've saw...
Looks like it weighs about 8 pounds.
I saw a picture of Richard Hamilton with his. The thing is bigger than my apartment in college. The Pistons ring does contain the biggest single diamond of any championship ring, according to people who make these, ridiculous gewgaws. But the largest ring was for the Florida Marlins, which had 243 diamonds.
I'm sure you were shocked to learn this week that the National Hockey League All-Star Game had been canceled.
What do you think, aren't they playing it in Switzerland?
What do you think the drop-dead date might be for the rest of the season and, while we're at it, the entire league?
Well, I think the sports fans of America have told the NHL to drop dead by not noticing the fact it isn't there. It was going to be in Atlanta. It was going to be a real showpiece for one of the new franchises. The NHL owners don't care. They want their salary cap, and they'll do anything they have to get it. I still think they're going to sit out the season, come back next year with a couple fewer teams and replacement players, and people won't notice them next year any more than they're noticing them right now.
In one of those Olympic stories that won't go away, various conspiracies are suspected in connection with the failure of some horses from Ireland to pass the doping tests in Athens last summer. Is no sport safe from the specter of chemical enhancement here?
Well, let's see. How many years do you get if you steal something in an equestrian competition?
Four, five, five, five. Thank you, Mr. Ed.
Oh, Wilbur, I'm not going to testify.
I don't feel like that, providing that sample,
there's
Wilbur.
There's some really odd elements to this story, as though the entire story itself is an odd.
Hard to believe.
Apparently, somebody stole a doping sample from the Olympic show jumping champion. I think Paul Hahn must be the happiest guy in America right now because he's not involved in any of this.
Speaking of enhancement, bicyclist Tyler Hamilton and the manager of the team for which he rides continue to maintain that the blood doping test Hamilton failed was flawed. Does the fact that a second member of that team has now apparently also tested positive for blood doping help or hurt those claims?
Well, I mean, it doesn't help in the public eye. I'm not biochemist to know enough about the test. But it looks like Tyler Hamilton at some point is going to wind up having to plea bargain this thing and lose at least a year.
In off-season baseball news, Charlie, former New York Yankee second baseman Willie Randolph was named manager of the New York Mets this week. Do we send congratulations or condolences?
You know, I think the Mets are doing the right thing. They brought in Omar Minaya, who did it with mirrors in Montreal, to be the general manager. They've hired Willie Randolph, who somebody should have hired 5 years ago. This is at least pointing the franchise in the right direction. It's not the holding action behind the Yankees that you got the impression the Mets were engaged in over the last 4 or 5 years.
Cubs fans have always been known as a cheerful, if resigned, lot, but maybe seeing the Red Sox win a World Series has soured them. Perhaps that explains why the shell of a hand grenade turned up in right field at Wrigley this week.
I mean, was there any doubt, though, that the Cub fan would throw a hand grenade that didn't go off? Seriously, it was rusted, it was hollowed out, they found it in right field. One of the police said somebody probably had a few drinks and lobbed it over the wall. That's good enough for me. Yeah. I don't think you have to be Sherlock Holmes to figure that out.
And finally, Charlie, my candidate for wager of the week goes to a bet made on behalf of Rosalind Strover from Sudbury in Suffolk, England. Her daughter-in-law placed a wager some time back that she would live to be 100, and apparently it wasn't jinxed because yesterday Ms. Strover collected.
Stay alive, Graham!
Right,
stay alive!
It's testimony to the righteousness of the William Hill bookmaking establishment, don't you think?
Well,
they
could
have sent somebody out there.
Is this going on in England? Are there bookmakers walking around looking at old people and, you know, checking the teeth and setting, you know, this guy is like 5-1, but this guy over in the pub here is 6-5 not to make it? Is this an entirely new field or what?
If Monty Python never did that gag, I don't know why they didn't. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
A horse is a horse, of course, of course. And no one can talk to a horse, of course. That is, of course, unless the horse is the famous Mr. Ed. Go right to the source and ask the horse. He'll give you the answer that you endorse. He's always on a steady course. Talk to Mr. Ed. Heep-o-yackety-yack a streak and waste your time a day. But Mr. Ed will never speak unless he has something to say. A horse is a horse, of course, of course.
Lots of 30-year-old former high school athletes dream of returning to the playing fields of their former glory, which tends to seem more glorious with each passing season. Bob Cowser, an English professor at St. Lawrence University, stepped from the fantasizing crowd and actually played football for a semi-pro team in Watertown, New York, and then he wrote Dream Season, a book chronicling the adventure. Bob Cowser joins me now from the studios at North Country Public Radio in Canton, New York. Bob, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
You played for a team called the Red and Black, a team that has a legendary history, at least in your corner of the world. Tell us a little bit about the club you joined.
Well, the club started in 1895. You know, of course, all this predates the NFL. And except for a few periods during wartime, et cetera, they've been playing consistently since that time. And as you said, it's a big deal here in the North Country of New York. Mm-hmm. It's front page, sports page news every Saturday.
You wrote that though you weighed well over 200 pounds, about 230, when you tried out for the red and black, you were afraid that you would be considered, quote, undersized. Did that turn out to be a problem?
It didn't. I think the problem was, you know, as pervasive as semi-pro football is, there are more than 500 teams in the country. I didn't, as an avid football fan, didn't know anything about it. So I didn't know if I was playing against athletes who were Arena League caliber or not. And I knew how big NFL defensive ends and NFL players were. Mm-hmm. So I really didn't have any idea. As it turned out, a lot of the defensive ends in this league were small, quick people who weighed even less than I did at 230. I am short, I have to say, but I didn't turn out to be as small as I was afraid I would turn out to be.
Actually, this is radio, so you don't have to say you're short. Nobody will know.
Or bald. Or slow. All of which are true.
You discovered early that there were players aiming to convince you that you'd made a bad mistake when you decided to try out for this team. Tell me how that became apparent.
It seemed like, frankly, from the very first practice, everything I said was looked at kind of disdainfully by a couple of gatekeepers on the team who thought it was their job to eliminate the riffraff. And they wanted to make sure that I wasn't riffraff right away. And so when I said, well, I thought I'd play nose guard, they said, well, we run a four-man front. There isn't a nose guard. And from that moment on, I really tried from the beginning to try to find a place where I could fit in so that I wouldn't get cut and wouldn't have anything to write about and wouldn't get to play. They tended to just every question I asked was met with a kind of disdain, which eventually went away, but it was there in the beginning.
Well, there was one guy who physically tried to knock you out of practice before the schedule even began.
That's right. That's right. A guy who turned out to be a friend of mine named Dave McNeil. When the coach put me at headhunter on the kickoff team, which is just to the right and left of the kicker, wedge buster, job is to go down and bust the wedge that the receiving team forms once the ball's kicked. I saw him counting out players to make sure that he would be lined up to block me. And this is a 270-pound former Army, current correctional officer. Yeah, we had some serious collisions. In fact, I didn't even think about tackling anybody. I just thought about trying to save myself and hit him as hard as I could. And frankly, just like on the schoolyard, that's how I gained his respect. Hmm.
Since the red and black players aren't paid, there's no way for a coach to discipline players who miss practices or even who miss games, and your quarterback fell into that category. How is it that teams like the red and black don't just fall apart?
It usually comes down to a handful of individuals, coaches and general managers who hold things together. You know, teams lose road games simply because guys can't get out of work to travel or because they're frustrated about playing time or something like that. In fact, the only way I got into the game in midseason and actually got some playing time was because we had to cross the border to go play in Montreal, and several of our players, for one reason or another, for minor run-ins with the law, couldn't cross the border. And, it's kind of an outlaw league. It is. And I think it's, you know, it's all, you know, we hear the phrase love of the game all the time. And that's what keeps people coming back. But when you're in a low point and you've lost a couple of games in a row and you have some injuries, teams show up with 21 players, 18 players. That surprised me.
Crowds at red and black games might charitably be characterized as sparse, and maybe the term crowd is the wrong term. You write of your shining moment in one game, quote, I rose from the dust of my sack to exactly no fanfare at all. Was it always like that?
Actually, you know, the red and black draw 1,000 to 2,000 fans per game, and that's the tops in the league. So, yeah, very often it was like that. But it was funny that I didn't notice it because you're so wrapped up in what's going on in the field. Friday Night Lights is probably a better characterization of what my high school experience was like in mm-hmm. Tennessee, where everybody was at the game on Friday night, even if they didn't like football. And here with these men, you know, we were the ones who cared, the guys on the field, and that was it.
The issue of what your wife makes of your choice to return to football winds through Dream Season. There's a particular passage in the book that dramatizes that sometime conflict, I think. Would you please read page 135?
I'd be happy to. I make it home early from Watertown one July evening, a light practice before our first exhibition game. It's 8:30, hardly dusk outside. But I find Candace and baby Jackson fast asleep on the couch, cheek to cheek. It's perfect. except for the huge wound I now see in the middle of the prominent forehead the boy has inherited from me, big as a silver dollar, bright red and glistening with ointment. He toddled right off the porch onto the concrete, head first. The abrasion will scab over in a couple of days. Babies heal so fast. But it's worse than any wound I will bring home from the gridiron that season. And I still can't look at pictures of Jackson from that time. When new pink skin eventually replaces the scab, we find that it glows red like a mood ring just before he screams or cries. The mood scab, we come to call it. "What were you doing when this happened?" I ask his mother when I wake her. "Gee, I don't know," she says, a little hot at the question and at my manner of asking. "What were you doing?"
Did your wife end up feeling okay about being married to a semi-pro football player who was on the road a lot?
She did. I think what I've written about are the flare-ups that occasionally happened when it just got too much. But she was, in the beginning, somebody who really pushed me to do it. You know, she understood. She had seen my brother and I watch football games. She knew how much it had mattered to us. And neither one of us could come up with a good reason why I shouldn't do it other than that I might get hurt. And so she did. And in fact, as I explained at the end of the book, her business put up money to help me start a team closer to where we live so I could eliminate the road trips to practice.
You interrupt the narrative in Dream Season at several points to write about your boyhood. And in one of those passages, you say, quote, "We had all grown up believing the game was the only route to manhood. Would I be right in assuming that some of the players on the red and black still feel that way?"
Yes, I think a lot of people who've played football at any point in their lives think that. And in fact, you know, I'm afraid some of my faculty colleagues must think I think that way. And I had to deal with a lot of those ideas when I came back to playing football because I had put a lot of them aside. And yet it was important to me to be thought of as a physical player. And my high school career had mattered a lot to me.
You have several references in the book to others who have written about football. Do you harbor a dream that perhaps you'll be the next George Plimpton?
That would be great. My dream for the book is that I make some comment about football or some apology for football that maybe, you know, I have a lot of colleagues who said, "Well, I read your book, but I skipped the football part." And
didn't take them long to read it then.
Well, I was going to say, there isn't much else there. And so I thought of it very often, especially when I talked about things like violence and those attitudes people have about football that they want to sort of extrapolate onto the rest of their entire lives. And I wanted to talk about that as a way of maybe apologizing for people who love football.
Bob Kauser is a professor in the English department at St. Lawrence University and a former defensive end. He's the author of Dream Season, A Professor Joins America's Oldest Semi-Pro Football Team, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. He joined me from the studios of North Country Public Radio. Bob, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Joel Hurd at North Country Public Radio. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again, sign up for our newsletter, or learn more about Bob Kauser's Dream Season, visit our website, onlyagame.org. In our final word, Professor Hugo Kamya agrees that there are benefits to being an old family friend with the captain of the football team.
Yes, Matthias does get me good seats, yeah.
Oh, rats. I thought Professor Kamya was an intelligent, thoughtful humanitarian, and now I learn he likes football. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.